All right, thank you. So we will move on to agenda papers 8, 8A, and 8B. So at its previous meeting, the committee discussed the exchange rate an entity uses in particular circumstances and decided to research possible narrow scope standard setting. These papers explore that possible narrow scope standard setting. Like Sue mentioned, we're not asking you to make any decisions today. So we will start our discussion with agenda paper 8. This paper describes our approach to the research and any boundaries within which we conducted our analysis. And based on our analysis in that paper, we think the committee should consider when a lack of exchangeability could arise and then develop requirements for the exchange rate an entity uses in those circumstances. We also think the committee should not reconsider any fundamental requirements in IS 21 or address other aspects of IS 21 as part of this project. Paragraph 21 summarizes our preliminary views. With that, I'll turn your attention to the question on page 6 and ask whether you have any advice or feedback.
Bruce.
Thanks. Yeah, as I think I've expressed before, I think this is something that needs to be addressed. As much as I appreciate it's not always the most common thing that happens, when it does happen, it has a fundamental impact on companies reporting in those countries. If I looked at the proposals you put, I think that we've probably got a better, you know, if we're looking to do something, I think a narrow scope amendment just on this issue is probably a better issue, would be the better approach than trying to relook at any of the key principles, continue if you ask 21. I just think that, given what I've gathered is the appetite of the board and the staff availability, I think a larger project would just take a long time. And the other reason I would support a narrow scope project on this is, once again, this is one of those things that needs to happen sooner rather than later, because when it suddenly happens in a country, it becomes very big very quickly. And we can't predict where it's happening, but there are some countries that are already teetering again in terms of their currencies are looking at the questionable, and I think it would be very proactive of the ISB to get something out sooner rather than later on this.
Thank you. Tony.
I agree with that. I think it's when it happens, it becomes urgent, and by the time it's possible to react to it, it's too late. So I think it's helpful. I agree with the recommendation that it's a narrow scope amendment that doesn't revisit any of the basic principles, but just tries a very surgical fix to address the issue.
Funny.
I also agree with the staff's proposed approach in terms of very narrow scope. I also think that it addresses a gap that doesn't currently exist today, and I think would be very helpful.
Thank you. Bertrand.
The same as my fellow members that previously spoke. I agree with the staff proposal to do a narrow scope amendment. And I felt the work that was done by the staff is very, very good, very accurate, very didactic. So we didn't know whether you could come up with such a proposal, but you did it. And I think it's a fair proposal here to do. And it will help, for sure.
Thank you.
I am supportive for the intended direction. It helps for Venezuela. We don't know what's going to happen in Argentina or other countries.
It's happening.
So, as said, and it will still take some time to develop and having it really out. But this is really something where IS-21 lacks more or less a little bit of clarity, and therefore I'm fully supportive.
Thank you.
And I also agree with staff's preliminary view.
That's good.
So let's keep it narrow.
Makes me feel positive that so many preparers are supportive. Of course, the firms as well. Take that in the spirit in which it was intended. Okay, move on.
Okay, so we'll now move on to agenda paper 8A. This paper presents our analysis and preliminary views. Firstly, on defining a lack of exchangeability. Paragraphs 17 to 60 present our analysis on this matter, and paragraphs 59 and 60 present our preliminary views. With that, I'll turn your attention to question 1 on page 15 and ask if you have any advice or feedback on the proposed definition of exchangeability.
So there's a number of different pieces to this, isn't there, Javid? And so to see a summary of that, probably as paragraph 6 and 7. So this will be addressing the summary that's in paragraph 6 and 7. Okay, Carl?
Yes, quick comment on paragraph 26. You mentioned in the middle of the paragraph, if the jurisdictional authority prohibited the existence of such a market and enforced such a prohibition. I'm concerned with the "and enforced," assuming that we'll go to the standard. I would be troubled with that existing in the wording of the standard. I think it will bring a lot of problems in practice to prove if it's enforced or not.
So you agree with the prohibit but not the enforcement aspect?
Yes. I would skip the ending force.
Guy.
I had a similar question about the phrase legally prevented, and it seemed to contemplate something perhaps different than legally permissible. And so I was pausing on that, and yeah, I guess first question is it different than legally permissible? And if so, why? Why were we trying to set a hurdle that was different than being legally permissible?
I think the idea was not for it to be different from legally permissible. It was just the terminology we used in saying that you're not prevented from accessing that market. It was more whether you have access to that market and legally you're not prevented from accessing it. So that was more the angle we came at it, but I don't think it was intended to be different. So we can certainly go back and look at the terminology again.
Okay. Yeah, so I have some preference for one set of words over another.
Yeah, I would have just thought about, you know, we should be considering what's legally permissible. And I read legally prevented as being an even further hurdle. So it might not be legally permissible, but, you know, there's no penalty for...
Might get to the enforceability point. Yeah. Okay.
So it definitely seemed to be in concept different than legally permissible, and I just wasn't sure I was comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe the other thing I would ask is this, in paragraph 7D, more than an insignificant amount test. I appreciate the objective to keep the project narrow in scope, but I wasn't appreciating the conceptual underpinning of that threshold beyond just, well, we want to keep this narrow, so we'll pick that as our arbitrary cutoff.
And I think that probably you pick up that our arguments in support of that in the paper, which paragraph? Our arguments, it's paragraph 57, but you rightly will note that we didn't argue on a conceptual basis for this. Others of you might identify conceptual basis. We didn't necessarily identify a conceptual basis for this. I suppose we thought it was an aspect we needed to consider because there are situations where you might be able to get access to some amount of foreign currency, but clearly nothing like what you might want to. So it seemed to be something we needed to address. We didn't identify any conceptual way of doing it, and so our thoughts about why we're going for more than insignificant versus something else is sort of set out in paragraph 57. But I will say yes, one argument is narrow. I think the other piece we mention at the minute is the kind of linking between what the requirements would be when you end up saying there's a lack of exchangeability in this, and it's almost because we are recommending in paper 8B to not put a lot of constraints around doing the estimation, then almost we thought in terms of then working out when you can do an estimation, we try and put some more, I suppose, boundaries around it. So there was a bit of an interplay there for us.
So I read it more as sort of a logic for a reasonable approach as opposed to anything deeply profound.
Yeah.
I could put it that way, yeah. Which I don't think is a bad thing. Reinhard, I'm going to let you in even though you weren't next, just so you don't have to keep waving.
No problem. Thank you for that. I thought the staff paper was well thought out, and although I had some minor comments for the staff to consider, the one issue that I found a little bit troubling is the distinction between when you have a temporary lack of exchangeability versus a long-term lack of exchangeability. And although I agree that long-term is other than temporary, I do think if we focus on just the words or the direction the staff is going, that a temporary lack of exchangeability is when the currency is not exchangeable at the end of the period, but is restored after that point in time, but before the finance statements are issued. I think that could sweep in circumstances where there's been a lack of exchangeability for quite a while, perhaps years, and that exchangeability did not exist at the balance sheet date, but gets restored thereafter. And using that rate may not be reflective of the circumstances that exist as at the balance sheet date. And so I thought that, although IAS 21 is not explicit, it was trying to get around circumstances where there was, exchangeability at the balance sheet date, but that was a very temporary kind of a situation. And so I just worry about making a definition based on temporary that focuses on restoration after the balance sheet date, that it might sweep into circumstances where that would, at least in my view, not be appropriate. Think about hyperinflationary situations as well, where the combination of IAS 21 with IAS 29 could get some unusual results. And so as I say, that's probably the biggest hurdle, the biggest concern I had about paper 8A, and wanted to raise.
Okay, thank you. Tony.
Yeah, like others, I think this is a really good paper. I think it's explored all the issues. I just really had a couple of either observations or questions for the staff as they take it forward. One thing that I don't think I saw in here, as you're thinking about exchangeability, is the notion of a normal administrative delay, which exists in IAS 21. And I sort of assumed that you would consider that in the same way as part of the analysis. Is that?
That is the idea, yes.
And it's probably related to Reinhardt's comment, but I also wondered about a lack of exchangeability during the year that may have been cured by the end of the year. And could you end up with a different answer for a company that does quarters to one that doesn't do quarters, or does a half year to one that doesn't do a half year? That would be consistent with IAS 34, and whether there's just an angle there that you might need to think through. I agree with Guy about the legally permissible notion. I'd made the same comment. And then when you talk about the long-term lack of exchangeability, and particularly looking at the example, you say, well, if the reason that a company, a parent, would seek exchange is to recover its investment in a subsidiary, and if it can't do that, that might mean that there's a long-term lack of exchangeability. Were you thinking recover it all in one go? Because my sense is there'd be a lot of circumstances where a parent could not liquidate and recover its subsidiary, but if it was to do it over a period of time through distributions or whatever, it would be able to. And I wonder if we might be broad, or it might be rather broader than you have in mind, if the test was, can you liquidate and recover the subsidiary tomorrow? Mm. So I think this is really good. Just a couple of things to think about.
Thank you. Andrew?
Like others, I very much like the direction of travel, and I thought these were very good papers as I went through them. Just to pick up on a couple of points. On the paragraph 46 point of the various thresholds, it seems to me that what we're trying to aim at is something where effectively this currency has just dried up. And I agree that A is one where you could work your way around it by exchanging one tiny bit of currency in your home. So if we're wanting to have something where it really has dried up, B seems to be the right place to go, because you're saying, I just can't exchange currency. And that's the one that takes you there. I had the same point as was raised earlier by Carl about the question of, in paragraph 26, of prohibiting black markets and enforcing that prohibition. I wondered whether we might look slightly sideways into the type of approach that's been taken in, for example, IFRIC 23, where detection risk is assumed. And that would then take away the need for enforceability, that you're just, you say if something's unlawful, it's unlawful, and you stop. And that might get you there. The only other thing that made me pause, and it was, I think it was Tony mentioned it, that made me think of it, was on the question of recovering the investment, there was one note of selling the investment to another party, and that might not be in the currency of the investee. And so there might be different steps that you would go through, because simply by being able to sell your subsidiary for a liquid currency doesn't change the characteristics of the currency in the sub.
Bonnie?
I also agree that the staff has done a really nice job with these two papers. I do have maybe a few questions. Some have already been asked by others, but maybe if I just kind of go through the paper and kind of talk through the questions that I had. So I also, to a point that Guy had made in terms of insignificance, we've experienced this, so it is relevant to be discussed. So I do think that it is important to address where some amount of currency can be exchanged, but not all. Perhaps this also goes to Tony's point of you may be able to get some out, but it may be for the purpose of operating transactions rather than for recovery of the investment. And so I think that's very jurisdictionally specific, but it could be relevant in terms of thinking about the different things to be addressed as you're considering what rate to use. In paragraph 8, where we talk about temporary lack of exchangeability, I had the same question as Tony in terms of if an entity is a quarterly reporter and we're saying a temporary lack of exchangeability would exist when there's not a rate at the end of the period, but it's been restored before the financials. And a long-term lack of exchangeability is something other than that over that one period. Is that really long enough to say that it's a long-term lack of exchangeability? And I think you could get to different answers depending on how frequently entities report. So I think that's important to think about and address. Let's see, what else did I have? One of the other questions I had, so in paragraphs 31 through, I guess, 30, I don't know what paragraph it ends, but where it's talking about the two different rates when you have transactions versus in a different presentation currency, maybe I didn't read it correctly, but I was trying to understand, could you have a situation where you have to apply multiple different rates for specific assets, specific liabilities? I don't know how any system could possibly do that, because even with hyperinflationary, when it has happened in the middle of a reporting, kind of a reporting period, well, not even at the end of a reporting period, in the middle of a year, there's lots of things that we're having to do outside the system in order to get the numbers to work. So I just think we need to be very, very careful about how this could be practically applied. if we're saying different assets and different liabilities are at different rates, and then we're presenting at different rates, the concept versus practical reality. And then I also had a question on kind of the legal, legally permissible, legally preventable, because I could see a situation where you have to use a government mandated exchange, but there's nothing that says you can't do this or you can't do that. And if you have a legal opinion from a law firm that says what you're proposing to do is legal, then I think you've considered it here, but I think you need to take care with that. And I guess just another conceptual question I had is, a parallel rate may not be legal, or the black market rate may not be legal, but in paper 8B, could that actually represent, even if they're not legal transactions, it may actually represent a more market rate than the government rate. And so could that be something that, while not legal, does economically represent what the true transactions would be at if they were legal, and if the government wasn't keeping the rate at some artificially low exchange rate? So those are just a couple of things that I think should be considered as you kind of go through and do more detailed analysis. I really commend the staff, because this is a bit of a tricky issue. And I know we have one specific situation that we're dealing with now, but to Bruce's point, it could happen in a lot of different locations. And so you need to kind of make it so that it can be applied to different situations.
Martin?
Yeah, thanks. A little bit to echo Bonnie. I mean, what we really see is the difference between lack of exchangeability and ability to repatriate capital at the point in time you like to do that. Because there are countries where you have to apply, so to say, for repatriation of capital. And there might be a specific pattern that you always get the approval for that, but then probably 3 or 6 months later. And the question for me, should this be in scope of our discussion or not? Because economically, you could then consider that you need to apply a specific forward rate or whatever, because at the point in time, at the balance sheet date, you are not able, or you lack of this exchangeability, because you're not allowed to exchange or to transfer the money. Or this could be labeled as restricted cash or whatever, but specifically not the all-in-one volume would work. I guess this is valid for much more countries as we are currently considering, and specifically also not necessarily only related to hyperinflationary countries. Second aspect is the question whether really an exchange rate has to be applied specifically for each transaction. This is a little bit in Bonnie's direction. I assume that one should at least consider and give a hint that if there is any material transaction which is out of typical exchange rate or range, then this should be considered to be treated separately or something like that. Otherwise, it really gets it's entering into a chaos. And last but not least, I guess we haven't talked about the question whether we talk about an insignificant portion or a significant portion of net investment. So what is the overall scope? We had two alternatives, alternative 2 and 3, which are more or less doable, so to say. Alternative 1 and 4 are the extremes. I could also consider to go for alternative 3, because that would mean that if there is such a sufficient part, that then more or less whatever is intended to be guided then would be applicable. Yeah. So I guess we have to have a discussion on that.
Okay. Thanks, Martin. Michael?
Just a couple of observations. So I think the direction is good as well. And I can see why you need to focus on the type of transaction and the ability, not the intention. One thing I struggled a little with slightly, and this is quite a technical point, I think, but maybe it's about how you specify, but we talk about the entity being able to obtain foreign currency quite often. That doesn't immediately sit with me when you've got a monetary asset rather than a monetary liability, because you tend, unless you mean it, obtaining it comes from the counterparty settling it, rather than usually an entity obtaining foreign currencies, I will get foreign currency to pay something.
Yeah.
And once you start thinking about whether your counterparty can get the foreign currency to pay, then are you still looking at the entity? So it's maybe just something to think through how that works.
Yep.
On the more than insignificant, I think this is echoing something Tony said, I stumbled a little when we talked about subsidiaries and presentation currency, because in general, there's no intention to liquidate foreign operations. And transition to presentation currency is not really about realization. It's just a convenience to present everything in the same currency. So I quite like the more than insignificant, because it makes it more about the theory of what we're trying to achieve presentationally, rather than if you say you've got to be able to get all the foreign currency to liquidate, that becomes much closer to you need some sort of intention or it sounds more like an intention than an ability. So I think the more than significance kind of supports that principle that you're just trying to get what would the rate be for this type of transaction. And then to find out, I also had the same issue with enforce. I thought that seemed to go a bit far in paragraph 26.
Thank you. Bertrand?
No, just to mention the fact that I agree with the staff paper and analysis and the direction taken in the paper. We can effectively discuss the two options, two and three, but I would I understand the path taken so far to retain more than an insignificant amount, so you two. So I would more be inclined to what is mentioned currently in the staff paper, in these regards.
Yeah.
Carl?
On this specific point, I'm lacking comfort in terms of if the more than significant amount will lead to an exchange rate which reflects the economics in reality. I'm not sure about that. Maybe I'm more with Martin in terms of something between 3 and 4 would maybe portray better the economics behind. I'm really not comfortable with the more than significant trigger. I'm not sure about that.
Mary.
My comment relates to a couple of the earlier comments rather than moving on to the not insignificant. I think it is important when thinking about, I think, some very good advice to the staff about the crossover between temporary and other than temporary. Because first of all, temporary is right now in 21 an entity-specific determination, because it's based on whether or not exchangeability has been restored before that entity's financial statements are authorized for issue. And what I hadn't thought of before, but I heard from the comments, is the question of, let's take an instance in which there's been lack of exchangeability for an extended period, multiple annual reporting periods, to not get to duck the issue for the moment of IS 34, for example. And the question is, once you have concluded that you have a long-term lack of exchangeability, should you flip back to short-term lack of exchangeability in the last period before exchangeability is restored? And I just think the staff has to think about that. It may be if, let's say, after 3 years of long-term lack of exchangeability, it becomes exchangeable after the fourth year has ended, but before the fourth year's financial statements are authorized for issue, the question of whether measuring everything at the first opening rate, which is what would happen if you flip back to short-term, provides useful information, or not, or if you need to structure this in such a way that once you go to long-term, you go out from long-term directly, you know, to something different rather than passing back through short term. I just hadn't thought about that aspect, but that's what some of the comments about lack of exchangeability. And then, Martin, you had referred to there's a process whereby you have to apply your past experiences that you get. You normally get permission, but maybe not for the quantity, but there's a period of some delay, so you don't know at the reporting date whether or not. I think that might go back to something that would fall under Tony's discussion of the normal administrative delay and thinking, you know, thinking about the circumstance. I think those two points could be brought together.
Thank you. Yang Su?
For the significant or insignificant pollution, I'm supportive of the staff position. So I think alternative two is the one that we have to go for. What I'm thinking is that allowing the estimated rate is an exception. It has never been allowed in the traditional accounting. So here what we do is to allowing some kind of exception, and the exception should be restricted in the extreme or exceptional situation. So I'm supportive of alternative two.
Okay, so I think Javid asked us to comment on question one, but at least some have also commented on question two. So I don't know whether there was any other comments on the temporary and long-term lack of exchangeability point, or whether everybody's raised the points they wanted to raise on 8A.
Okay, so we'll conclude today's discussion with agenda paper 8B. Now, in that paper, we set out our analysis and views on the requirements that could apply when a currency is subject to a lack of exchangeability. As explained in paragraph 12 to 37 of the paper, we think an entity should estimate a spot exchange rate when there is a long-term lack of exchangeability. When there is a temporary lack of exchangeability, we think an entity should use the first subsequent rate at which exchanges could be made. The paper then analyzes, in paragraph 38 to 52, our preliminary views on whether any specific disclosure requirements are needed. So with that, I'll turn your attention to the question on page 17 and ask whether you have any advice or feedback.
Bruce?
Thanks. I mean, I think we went over a little bit of this and we discussed in the paper the other day. I haven't had too much of a problem with the idea of estimating. I think it's the only real way you can go. I think a discussion earlier, I wouldn't underestimate. I think that the complexity of that estimation itself shouldn't be ignored. Not that I think that the ISP is going to come up with a solution for that. I think that's going to be, as you've put into all the appendices, I mean, that's going to be quite an interesting discussion to have. Which is why, as a result of that, I would be supportive of the estimation. I do agree that there are additional disclosures required. I think that this is, you can build it into kind of the IS1 stuff, but I just think this is such a unique situation. I think we need to give people very clear guidance on what they should be putting in there. The only other comment I had was on the temporary lack of exchangeability. I kind of had one scenario where I had a little bit of a challenge with it, and that was the timing. So we say that if it's restored by the time you report, what if we're dealing with a non-publicly accountable entity who may be able to delay their reporting for 2 or 3 years? Does that mean 3 years down the line, when now it's exchangeable, it's going to give me reliable, relevant information for my reporting year 3 years ago? And I don't know how much we wanted to reopen that, but to me the issue there was, should we not be having some degree of saying, look, there is a point at which if you haven't done your reporting, it gets too far down the track. Maybe the principles will, it's restored 3 years down the line, you can go back, shouldn't really apply. There is a point where you say, look, an estimate would have been more reliable in terms of that. So we haven't really given any of a time indication what we consider that. And I just know that from my experience, when some of the companies we deal with had those problems in some of the countries where they couldn't get the exchangeability, they just waited on their reporting because they didn't have any public reporting requirements. Mm. So that was the only comment I had.
Okay. Bertrand?
Yeah, similar to Bruce, I agree with the staff paper and the staff recommendation in the paper. I think effectively in those specific circumstances you need to estimate, and I acknowledge the fact that, like Bruce said, it will be very difficult to have a uniform methodology for this estimation. So probably the direction or the route you've taken in the paper is fine. Allow for an estimation without necessarily explaining how to estimate. Probably it's the proper way to deal with that. And then, effectively, then if it's material, you need to disclose what you've done. Fair enough.
Yes, I understand the estimation process is the only option left. But when it goes to FX, I'm really concerned with how close to accurate an estimation process will lead. There is, you pointed out well in 21A that there is lack of consensus in about that on with the economists. I understand it's the only option left, but I'm still not sure if it will lead to something even close to accurate. That's a concern I have. The obvious textbook process is to add inflation, the purchase price, but however, there are more 20 possibilities involved, political risks and so on. So the process of estimate accurately effects is something very, very difficult, very hard to find.
Bonnie?
I reiterate my comments that I made last time, that I agree with Carl that if you don't have a rate, estimation seems to be the only other option. I think it could beg the question, if there is a black market rate, can that be a reflection of what an economic rate would be? I also agree that if there is an estimation of a rate, disclosure has to be there, because that's the only way that a reader of the financials would be able to give, to understand how the rate was calculated, what the rate is that's used, and also kind of the net assets and liabilities, net monetary assets and liabilities, or net assets and liabilities in the case of hyperinflation, to be able to do some sort of, okay, well, if I think it's 10% higher or lower, here's what the impact would be. And I think that's important information for a reader of the financial statements.
Thank you. Goran?
Yes. I like Staff's analysis and conclusion, and particularly that for the long-term lack of exchangeability, that I think that it is very sensible for the ex-portfolio manager's point of view that to use purchasing power parity, which is a kind of good, the indication. It, of course, it is not the perfect, but still it will provide us a good, first approach to find what is the economic reality of the situation. And also that disclosure for then long-term lack of exchangeability. I think that this is a good recommendation. But my concern is that the disclosure on the temporary lack of exchangeability. You are saying that no specific disclosure should be required when there is a temporary lack of exchangeability. But I'm afraid that the situation where we see, even if a temporary lack of exchangeability, that is a very, very volatile situation. And only as a hindsight, we can say this is a temporary lack of exchangeability. It could easily to long-term exchangeability, long-term lack of exchangeability. And also that when we have a temporary lack of exchangeability, that we use subsequent that the spot rate. But, if this situation, temporary lack of exchangeability, move to the long term, I'm afraid that we would see a very huge depreciation of the currency, which means that the exposure measured at this temporary spot rate could easily lead to a very huge losses. Therefore, I want to have a specific disclosure even for the temporary lack of exchangeability, including that the fact that the preparers to judge at this moment, this is a temporary, and also that the what kind of rate, what was the subsequent rate, and also the exposure to that currency. Again, that this exposure measured at the spot rate could easily be, you know, at the risk of huge losses in the near future.
Okay, thank you. Marie.
Yeah, we will definitely support this paper and think it's really helpful. We do really understand the challenge to work or to say something on a model, but we're thinking of, is it not possible to do at least some elements or just to put some ring fence just to make sure that you do not have too many possibilities. We fully agree that the disclosure are key in this element and what they suggest is helpful. Maybe there can also be the sensibility to the key hypothesis of the model, which is not something I think you catch. And regarding the temporary lack of exchangeability, maybe you can at least have disclosure on the fact that there was a temporary lack of disclosure. I think the exposure will be captured by IFRS 7, but it can be reminded as well, something important.
Okay, thank you. Mary?
A couple of things. You know, Bruce, in an earlier comment in this round, raised the issue of a company that may hold issuing its financial statements for an extended period of time. And while I understand the discomfort with the idea, I think partly it may be answered by the suggestion that staff go back and think about whether you pass back through that temporary lack of exchangeability, whether that produces useful information. But the other caution that I'd issue that I think the caution that I'd give that I think we'll have to consider is IAS 10 itself, events after the events after the balance sheet date is going to be my shorthand for it. It has a better title. Doesn't have any backstop on the look-back period, mm-hmm. which can produce some funny answers, especially with respect to, let's say, long-running litigation, mm-hmm. if an entity is issuing financial statements for the first time, et cetera. So I think inconsistency, I mean, while the existing guidance on temporary lack of exchangeability doesn't say, based on IAS 10, you do X. It seems to be very much an IAS 10 type approach. So I think inconsistency with IAS 10 is something to be very cautious about, even though intuitively it may not make sense to say, well, these guys have got 2 years of financial statements waiting to be issued. You know, what do we do then? I think you have to think about it in connection with that. Do you pass through temporary? And, you know, Young-Soo made a point earlier on that I think as a board member, it's very important to keep in mind as we think about these things. And I know it's hard for me as a board member when we're doing full-scale standard setting, is it's a rare circumstance in which you are creating an exception that doesn't exist today, you know, to say step away from the rates. And so... The thing that's difficult is avoiding scope creep or thinking about what something should be ideally rather than working within the constraints and trying to keep it narrow. So, for example, I think, and this kind of goes back to 8A, it's important that people only get in, to me, that people only get into estimation when there really is lack of exchangeability as opposed to I disagree with the indicated rate from, you know, that is accessible. You know, and you may think that that isn't a sensible rate or may cause some distortions, but if it is actually accessible, you know, so there is not lack of exchangeability, I think saying because I disagree with it and I'm going to estimate what I think is a more faithful rate would be more significant and has to be written in a way, you know, I say this from a board observer perspective, that that avoids that, because that really opens up IS 21 quite widely. But I think we then have to accept that when people get to estimation, they may really have quite different estimates of what the rate is. I think Bonnie's point about perhaps some kind of sensitivity analysis is, you know, is at least worth considering as a step in disclosure. But I think it also does argue quite strongly for thinking about what disclosures in GORA we may be pulling, especially on you as a user of financial statements, to understand what users need to know about that estimation in order to to understand the financial statements prepared that way. Because I think, well, if done properly, it can constrain people from stepping away, except in the most extreme cases of true lack of exchangeability. Once you get away, you're going to get a fairly wide range of estimation, and not because people are evil or manipulative, just because it's a very difficult thing to do.
Can I just make a comment on that? I agree with you completely. We've got to be very careful allowing people to estimate too far. Just on the IS 10 issue, I also call events after balance sheet dates, et cetera, because my only concern there is just that there's a period over which I'm saying I think that you get to a point where the rate that eventually becomes achievable is not evidence of what happened. You know, it's unlike IS 10, which is giving us evidence of things that could have existed balance sheet date. I think there's a point where we get to a point where 2 years down the line, the rate that comes out there just bears no resemblance to what actually happened at that point. And it's just a question maybe for the staff to investigate and say, you know what I'm saying, is it get to a stage where it's actually not inconsistent with IS 10? You've kind of gone from something that was almost an adjusting event to a non-adjusting event because the time has got so far that it's just no longer relevant to what you're reporting on. So that's kind of where my concern was.
Yeah, and I think it'll come back to actually thinking, some of it is just grinding through the mechanics and saying, well, if ultimately you would catch up for retained earnings to that rate, should you be forcing it to that rate anyway in the previous financial statements?
And
that's where I think it's just grinding through. I can't visualize that.
John, well, repeating what people have said previously, I agree that this ought to be narrow, and I agree with the direction in which the staff paper has gone. I don't think we should set parameters around estimating other than to say that you've got to take into account all the relevant circumstances, and then beyond that, disclosure becomes the key explaining what you've done. I tend to agree with Goro. I think that there are some relevant disclosures around a temporary lack of exchangeability as well.
Thank you. Marshall?
Here, referring to paragraph 23, and the question which weight should be applied, and then Mary also said, well, if it is an estimation, then there could be a certain bandwidth between the entities. And here the question is raised whether a blended rate or an estimated rate should be used, so to say. Whereas if I apply a blended rate, I have something, and then I have a residual, and for the residual I apply the estimated rate. And I will give you a practical example. Consider a high US dollar offshore account for a Venezuelan company. So you should consider to exchange now the US dollar into Venezuelan bolivar and then the bolivar into euro. And you see already that this gets diluted, so to say, so with regard to clarity. You could also directly exchange the US dollar into euro because you are allowed to do so. And if this is a bigger portion, say 10 or 15% of the overall whatever value of the company, then I would clearly prefer a blended rate than an estimated rate. And I guess as it is all about disclosures anyhow, because we are talking about a big bandwidth, I should give some flexibility with regard to that if I have a significant part where I apply a different exchange rate. I would open it up more or less for explanation because that could lead to a better economic picture of the company than just using an overall estimated rate above.
Thank you.
So, sorry, can I just ask a clarifying question? So I think, Martin, in your example, let's say if you could get access to 15%, say, of whatever the balance is, you're saying you would apply then the actual rate you could get access to for the 15% official rate, right, for want of a better word, and then just apply the estimate to the 85%.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Yeah. Jim?
I agree with the staff analysis, and I like the way this paper is approaching this massive uncertainties we're dealing with, because for an entity to make an estimate on the country or on the kind of local jurisdictions and the uncertainties is very difficult for sure. And as long as we could, or we have this disclosure requirement, I think we're fine. We don't need to worry too much about, as Carl mentioned, the accuracy or reasonableness of these estimates. They're estimates. And we have all these inputs. And obviously, if the management could put it down and disclose, they have their reasons. And we don't need to worry about it. At the end of the day, each company may have their own race. They may be different, and they should. They should be different. All these inputs, they could be black market rates or some kind of a level of foreign currency exchangeability. And we have the financial positions. All here, we have our methodology. We're fine. Just to deal with complexity. And we don't need to kill us for the accuracy. We won't get there.
Okay, thank you. Andrew?
I, again, like others, agree with the approach in the staff paper. I think it does need to be a very narrow approach that we take. The other thing that just occurred to me a little bit, and it takes me back to paragraph 24 again, is that I think I'd like us to be quite clear that if there is an official rate that you can get, even though you have to wait quite a while and maybe put the money through in the small parcels, that's still the rate that you can get. And the reason for mentioning that is it comes back to the same country as was mentioned before. That in Venezuela, you did have the official rates, but it was quite tricky to get your money out. And what I wouldn't want is for some to argue that, well, because it's difficult and I can't really get all that much of it out, so I'll just use an estimated rate for the rest. Because that's not, I think, where we were a few years ago with that country. We're in a different place now. In terms of the input, while I do agree that there needs to be judgment around what's used, I think that there are certain inputs that perhaps are more relevant than others. People have talked about inflation indices and other ones. I just wondered whether there might be some way of thinking about some primary indicators, and then if you think you need to use some more, here are some secondary ones to think about and look at it in that context. And like others, I do think that there are some countries that I can think of at the moment where if you look at the various rates that you can observe, the black market rate isn't a bad indicator of at least the kind of ballpark that you should be in. So perhaps think a little bit about how that could hold together. On the disclosures, I do think we need some specific ones. I quite like Bonnie's idea of some sensitivity of what would happen if it moved around a bit. It gives a nice indication of how significant this particular issue is to the reporting entity.
Speaking of Bonnie, Bonnie.
I actually wanted to clarify that point. I wasn't suggesting that we disclose a sensitivity like for pensions. What I was suggesting was that the significant assumptions, kind of the significant information that if a reader wanted to do their own sensitivity, they would have the base information to do so. Okay. So I did. That was actually what my sign was up. I wanted to clarify what I meant because I didn't want to be attributed to something that.
Bonnie, just to clarify, you're saying
Bonnie
disclosure
responsible for blessing black man.
Just to clarify, you're suggesting disclosure of the significant assumptions you've used in coming up with your
estimate,
as opposed to saying, "I'm going to show you if those assumptions moved."
Like, what are the base assumptions for for coming up with the rate. And I'm thinking, I should know the references, like IFRS 13, where you, or yep. the
significant inputs.
Yes, thank you. Yep. There was another point that I wanted to make in relation to something Andrew said. Now I don't remember what it was.
What did I say?
You talked about the sensitivity. What was the first point that you made?
Oh, it was the Venezuela point, and if you could just get little parcels of money out.
Yeah, so I did want to make a note about that, because to me that goes back to the insignificant amount or significance in determining whether or not there was a long-term lack of exchangeability. And it could be different entity by entity. Like, for instance, pharmaceuticals may have had priority, in which case they were able to get more money out. Non-pharmaceuticals may have been in a different situation, and there were hundreds of thousands of dollars that could come out versus the millions that were needed to keep production running. So I do want to take care with that, your point, and to me that goes back to the significance and kind of alternative two and alternative three that was in agenda paper 8A.
Mm. Well, that was one of the reasons why I quite liked alternative two rather than three, because I thought that in that circumstance it would perhaps help to stop people jumping to an easier answer rather quickly.
Yeah, I agree. I think this should be very limited circumstances that you're estimating a rate, because I think it is difficult. I think it is complex. I think you will get different rates between entities. Some of that is because, at least in Venezuela, you may be in a different industry, so there could be different facts and circumstances. Maybe not. There's been an evolution. So, you know, I agree we should... This should be a very limited circumstance that you have to estimate a rate.
Okay, Michael.
Just to clarify one point. So in paper 8B, I mean, it's clear that estimating the exchange rate, there's lots of judgment involved, and everybody's agreed with that. But I guess what I want to be clear on is just what the objective is. And I think what I'm hearing is that the objective is to estimate a market rate or kind of a true floating spot rate or whatever. Just when I read the words in paragraph 13, the objective, it talks about what you'd be able to access had exchangeability not been lacking and the exchange rate had been set through a legally permissible exchange mechanism or market to faithfully reflect prevailing economic conditions. I could read that as you want me to try and estimate what the rate would have been set by the mechanism, which wouldn't be... Mm. The floating rate. So I wonder if we just want to work on that wording. I think it's
is
slightly...
it okay if it's, because I think is the piece okay that kind of picks up the faithfully reflect prevailing economic conditions? Because I think that was maybe our focus. And...
Well, even that, because the conditions in the economy and what the government might set might reflect economic conditions, but it wouldn't be a market rate necessarily. Mm. So.
Sorry, I was thinking about prevailing economic conditions, but it'd be market. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Market.
Yeah. Okay, Young Soo.
Okay, actually, I didn't want to say anything.
Okay.
Because I support almost everything that Steph proposed. But, you know, when I listen to the other people, I think I have to say two things. The first one is about providing specific guidance. And I don't think we have to provide any specific guidance on estimating the rate. There could be many reasons, like, you know, maybe not the current available model of estimation would be proper in the future. In the future, maybe we're going to have a better model. So we have to open the possibility. And also, I don't think one model is appropriate for every situation. So each jurisdiction will have a different characteristics and may need a different model. So we have to open for estimation of the rate. So I agree with not Bonnie, but Mary and Andy, that a sensitivity analysis is important. So, you know, we have to require sensitivity analysis specifically for estimated rate, even though IIS-1 requires some kind of sensitivity analysis. Maybe in this one, we have to specifically require a sensitivity analysis in the amendment. And the last one I want to say is about the blended approach. And I think Martin says something about that. Maybe we have to, you know, apply the actual rate to the exchangeable amount. and non, you know, the estimated rate to the unexchangeable amount. And I don't think that is necessary. Since we said insignificant amount is going to be very small. So even if we apply the actual rate to the insignificant amount, you know, that is not going to be material at all. It is not going to produce any material amount. And also, I think, estimated rate is going to be very similar to the actual rate. So I kind of oppose to the blended approach. I prefer, you know, the using just one single estimated rate for all the exchangeable or non-exchangeable amount.
Thank you. Marie?
Just to clarify, I was suggesting a sensitivity, considering that it would make sense if we have a different way just to approach the estimation.
It'd be good to look at what we require for disclosures in other situations where we require estimates.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, just some comments on the sensitivity. Yeah, of course, as users of financial statement. Yeah. Yeah. If the sensitivity analysis is provided, that would be welcome. But I do understand. And the users anyway are very demanding. So if you propose it, we would welcome it. But I do understand that this, you know, that estimation, particularly for that the long term lack of exchangeability, it should be extremely difficult. So that estimate itself is not very, you know, and that you know the confidence in the estimate should not be very high anyway. And the particularly that the important thing is that key input. And the, I guess that there's a situation like Venezuela, that the case like Venezuela, that the country should suffer, is very likely to suffer from the hyperinflation type things. And the estimate of the key input or the estimate assumption on the inflation itself should be very, very volatile, or that the you know, huge band of, estimation. So that, that the important thing is that I think that the key input here. So if we could know that how plausible the key input is, that the user can judge that how the estimated spot rate is reliable or not. And anyway, that we need to have some kind of estimates to translate, to integrate the exposure to this country to the financial statement. So, I think that the proposed method or that the recommended method of PPP provides a kind of sensible approach, although I know that this is not the only approach. And the other approach should be, permitted. But still that if the company would disclose that the methodologies and the key inputs, we know that how conservatives or the companies are making, or that the company views that the situation is that on the key inputs like inflation rate, etc. And I think that is a very important thing. And even though there is no sensitivity analysis.
Thanks, Gary. Martin?
Yeah, probably one remark to Bonnie, because you refer to the pharmaceutical industry. Also, the pharmaceutical industry, unfortunately, is not able to get any money out of Venezuela, although they get promised a preferred rate. That's for sure. But then you are not able to exchange the money anyhow. So you have, in a way, so it lasts to the same purely conclusion example. That you have to apply a kind of rate you expect to get later on. But that was not my main point. with regard to sensitivities, I guess we have to be very careful with regard to disclosure overload. Or so if we would request a sensitivity analysis in any case, so assume, for example, the balance sheet overall impact for the group would be below 1% or so, I wouldn't expect any sensitivity analysis or so. For me, really, disclosure is key. And it's very important to disclose the exchange rate. Yes, I would assume that, because then any analyst, investor, whatever, could set up its own picture how, in his eyes, conservative or progressive or whatever a company is with regard to the exchange rate. And then with regard to Jiangsu, that perfectly explains a little bit our potentially different views on the topic, because in my scenario, then, if there is a company having a 10 or 15% offshore deposit in hard currency, you would then assume, no, the whole thing is not applicable, although the predominant business source is sitting in such a country where you have this lack of exchangeability. And I would say, yes, it has to be applied, yeah, because the predominant part of the business is there. And the fact that I have, for what reason ever, kind of this offshore account should not impact my accounting for this subsidiary. So therefore, I said, with regard to the alternative 2 and 3, we should probably have a debate on that.
Yeah, actually, for that, I'm not quite sure what we really mean by insignificant.
Yeah.
10%, 5%, 1%?
Yeah.
You never know. And what I think is that what staff is proposing is a very small amount, not even 10%. So that is, I mean, since we do not, I mean, in Korea we have done some kind of study about the probability terms, mm-hmm. and even the English, you know, the native English-speaking people has a different ideas about the expressions about insignificance or something like that. So by insignificance, what I meant is not even 10%. If it's 10% or 15%, I'll support you. But what I think is maybe just 1 or 2%. It's going to be in Montoya. That is my thought.
The words "more than insignificant" remind me of our first exposure, second maybe exposure draft on IFRS 9, ECL. Reinhardt, did you want to come in at all?
So I think the points I had were covered by others. The one point I would come back to, though, is I think in terms of the distinction between temporary and long-term, I do agree with the comments that were made by Coral that I think disclosure of what the fact that you assumed or considered the exchange rate to be temporary, the judgments you made, that is important. And so I do think, because at the end of the day, no matter how we approach it, there will be judgment as to the point in time between when you pass between temporary and long term. And so disclosure about those judgments that you made are important.
Thank you. Mary, did you want to come back in?
I did. Just I wanted to urge some caution thinking about the blended rate point, because I'm going to make a generic statement, then I'll offer an observation about a twist that we face in this project. The basic statement is, my sense of the project is that you're trying to make a determination about whether the currency is exchangeable or not. And it's not an attempt to say, what amount can I realize for my individual items? And this almost maybe goes back to Bonnie's very early statement about, you know, different rates for different items, for different lines. But presumably, is this currency exchangeable or not? And if it's not, then I have to estimate a rate. Versus, let's say, a situation of saying what you're trying to do is estimate the rate at which each of the line items and the accumulated capital would be settled or repatriated, and that's a very different measurement model. You know, the normal IS-21 is saying translate, it's a translation exercise that doesn't assume that it assumes that you're trying to do everything at the reporting date or reflect the events during the year, even if you have no intention, of repatriating it. So to me, the blended rate notion is more saying, it's more like the kind of shift that you make when you move to IFRS 5 and assets held for sale. We're saying, okay, now that I've formed an intent to do a specific unusual type of activity, I have to rebase my measurement. It's almost liquidation. Now, the wrinkle in all this that I said I would make, that's a caveat to it, is that, to that statement, is in some settings, and it may not be the case today in Venezuela, although it might have been the case in Venezuela 18 months, 2 years ago, and I'm just making up those time periods, I haven't come back and looked, the determination of whether the currency is exchangeable or not as an absolute threshold question could have varied by company. And so that's the weird thing, is you've got the intersection of two things. But some of the mechanics, like the blended rate, I think the staff was right to raise it as a possibility. But I think we have to go back and step back and say, what is the objective of this exercise? And if it's the unusual circumstance in which you determine that there's a long-term lack of exchangeability, I think then going to some kind of blended or item-specific estimate of rate implies a different kind of measurement exercise than underlies IS-21's translation, for especially for the purpose of consolidation.
That's fair. And just two other observations, partly reflecting on some of the comments that have been raised along the way. I think similar to other situations where we're asking people to come up with estimates, and so I'm thinking of expected credit losses, of course.
And really, that's the first thing that would come to your mind.
And fair value measurements. We're very clear what it is the sort of measurement objective is. So this is what we're asking you to shoot for. And then people can have different approaches, but everybody knows that's what they're aiming for. Yep. So I think here, because we're not going to, I think, rightly specify how to do the estimates, we need to work on being very clear what it is that people are being asked to measure.
Yeah, which Michael's comments.
Which Michael's comments made me think of that. And also, I think, on the whole disclosure piece, it's probably a good case for where we should step back a little bit instead of starting to list what the information is we need, maybe step back and think about what's the objective of the disclosures? What is it we want people to understand? And it's probably that we had to make an estimate and why and sort of what the key inputs are. The reason I'm thinking about this one is because if you think about the sensitivity type analysis on IFRS 13, we get a lot of feedback that it's very mechanical and not necessarily written in a way that makes people understand what the purpose of the whole exercise is. So if what we're trying to do is make people understand, to Goro's point, these were my key inputs, and there were other sort of very valid ways of thinking about those inputs, but if I'd used those instead, how big an effect would it have had, that sort of thinking? Not, you know, if the rate were to change by this much next year, what's the impact? But what's my sort of flex at the measurement date, and what judgments did I have to make, and how important they are? Sort of thinking about what the objectives of the disclosures are might help give us some context for working up the detail. I think that was a really good discussion, good mix of practical considerations, extra things to think about, interactions with other standards. Yang Su?
The reason why I said sensitivity analysis is important because it would enable us to compare the financial statements of different companies, different entities. If different entities are using different weights,
maybe
their financial statements will not be comparable. But if you have any information about the sensitivity, then we can adjust the financial statements to make the financial statements comparable between companies. That's why I said sensitivity analysis. Maybe analysts do not like it.
But I think we need to think about what the objective of the sensitivity and the analysis is, maybe talking with some investors and tapping into Goro a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. And we should pass on to Vincent the compliments about the quality of the papers, which really were a good foundation for a good discussion and got lots of positive comment, which is great given the complexity of the topic. Okay, I think we should just keep going because we're nearly at the end.